December 6th, 1975, Teaneck, New Jersey. After spending the night in New York City, 40-year-old Wesley Diggs returns to a suburban home and discovers that his entire family has been murdered. Wesley's 39-year-old wife Jean and their four children, 17-year-old Audrey, 16-year-old Allison, 12-year-old Wesley Jr., and 5-year-old Roger, have each been shot multiple times, and there are no signs of any forced entry. While Wesley is not considered a suspect in the murders, police imply that he might know more than he's letting on. Since the investigation fails to turn up any promising leads or solid evidence pointing to a specific suspect, the Diggs family murders remain unsolved. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today we're going to be covering a surprisingly little-known cold case about the massacre of a mother and her four children, the 1975 murders of the Diggs family. Due to the events which are taking place in the world right now, I've decided that every episode that The Trail Went Cold releases over the course of the next month will cover an unsolved cold case in which the victims were persons of color. And here, we have an horrific story involving five murder victims from the same family. Years before they were killed, the Diggses became the first African-American family to move into what was at that point an all-white, middle-class neighborhood, but they were welcomed with open arms. That's why it came as a complete shocker when someone entered the Diggs residence in the middle of the night and shot the mother Jean and her four children several times each. The father Wesley owned a number of bars in Harlem, which often required him to work long hours, so he was not present when these murders took place, and wound up discovering his family's bodies. On the surface, it seemed like Wesley was left completely devastated by the ordeal, and there was no evidence to suggest he committed the murders or was personally involved in the crime, but some investigators always seemed to have this nagging feeling that he knew more than he let on. Wesley has since passed away, and went to his grave maintaining that he shared everything he knew with the police. Whatever the case, the investigation was unable to uncover any solid suspects or a logical motive for why this crime took place. While a few theories have been presented, none of them make complete sense, but we're going to explore them all on today's episode. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now delve into the Diggs family murders. Our story begins in 1975 in Teaneck, New Jersey, a township with a population of around 40,000 located in Bergen County, just across the Hudson River from New York City's metropolitan area. Our central figures are an African-American family, 40-year-old Wesley Diggs, his 39-year-old wife, Jean Diggs, and their four children, 17-year-old Audrey, 16-year-old Allison, 12-year-old Wesley Jr., and 5-year-old Roger. The Diggses originally hail from Harlem and currently live inside a two-story colonial-style house in a suburban neighborhood on Carlton Terrace. They moved into their home in 1970, making themselves the first black family to move into what had been an all-white neighborhood for the previous four decades. However, the Diggses had no issues being welcomed and accepted by their neighbors, and became a very well-liked and respected family within the community. By 1975, approximately 16% of Teaneck's population was black, and the township had developed a reputation for racial equanimity. Wesley, who used to work for the Harlem Board of Education and was a former professional saxophone player, spends a large chunk of his time in New York, as he owns four bars and a stationery store in Harlem. This often requires him to work 16 to 18 hour days, and he will sometimes spend the night at an apartment in the city in order to avoid the commute back home. Jean has the primary responsibility of running the household and raising the children, though she does have a part-time job at Stern's department store and also works as an Avon lady, selling cosmetics to her neighbors. On the afternoon of Saturday, December the 6th, after having spent the previous night and the first part of the day in New York City, Wesley returned to his home in Teaneck shortly after 4:30 p.m. He entered the house and went upstairs, where he noticed that his daughter Audrey was lying on the bed inside Wesley Jr.'s bedroom. After entering the room, Wesley was soon horrified to discover that Audrey appeared to be seriously wounded and the mattress was soaked with blood. He attempted to use the phone to call for help and found out that the line was dead, but after remembering that his next-door neighbor had a daughter who was a nurse, he ran over to their house for assistance and had them contact the police. When the nurse went to the Diggs residence to check Audrey's body, she confirmed that Audrey was dead. Police soon arrived at the scene and would discover that Jean, Audrey, Allison, Wesley Jr., and Roger had all been murdered after being shot multiple times with a .22 caliber weapon. Jean was lying dead on a powdered bench in the basement recreation room and had been shot once in both the forehead and the chest. Audrey was shot three times in the head and twice in the back. Wesley Jr. and Roger were both found lying face down on top of the bed inside Roger's room. Wesley Jr. was shot three times in the back of the head, while Roger was shot there twice. Allison slept in the attic and was found murdered in her bed. She was lying on her side and had been shot twice in the back of the head, and a television was still running there when police arrived. Additional bullet holes were discovered in the walls of the attic, the two bedrooms, and the downstairs rec room. A total of 26 spent shell casings were found in the residence, and ballistics tests would later determine that only 23 of them came from the same gun, meaning that at least two different .22 caliber firearms were used. While no murder weapon could be found, a .22 caliber automatic pistol, which Jean reportedly kept in the kitchen for protection, was missing. There were no signs of any forced entry, struggle, or sexual assault on any of the victims, and nothing appeared to have been stolen, prompting one police officer to describe the residence as the quote-unquote cleanest crime scene I ever saw. Three of the murdered children were dressed in their pajamas, and since it was estimated that the victims were dead for at least 14 hours before they were discovered, the approximate time of the murders was likely between 11 p.m. and 2 a.m. No one else in the neighborhood reported hearing gunshots or anything unusual that night, and the last confirmed sighting of anyone from the family being alive came from a neighbor who claimed to have seen the two boys at around 4 p.m. on December the 6th. Wesley would be questioned by the authorities to corroborate his alibi during the approximate time period his family was killed. That evening, a political fundraiser for a New York State Assembly candidate was held at Diggs's Den, one of the bars Wesley owned in Harlem, and a number of eyewitnesses would confirm that he was there. Afterward, Wesley spent the night with a girlfriend of his at her apartment in the Bronx. By his own admission, Wesley did carry on affairs with other women, and while he claimed that Jean was not particularly happy about the situation, she accepted it. Wesley said that when morning hit, he spent some time meeting with his accountant and then went to pick up the cash receipts from each of his bars before he headed back home to Teaneck. Wesley owned his own .38 caliber pistol, which he was carrying when he discovered his family's bodies, but it was confiscated by police and determined not to have been used in the crime. He wound up passing a polygraph test, and while he was never considered to be a suspect, some investigators believed he might have known more than he was letting on. In other words, he might have had some idea about who committed the crime, but would not say so. It turned out that the expenses from running four separate bars had placed Wesley in heavy debt, as he took out a mortgage on his home and borrowed over $100,000 from a man named Murray Skidelsky, who ran a loan company. Wesley was also required to put up his home as collateral and pay back Skidelsky in weekly installments of up to $1,000. Skidelsky raised a few eyebrows because years earlier, he had loaned money to a prominent mob figure named John Masilo, but Skidelsky insisted he did not know about Masilo's mob ties at the time, and that all of his business dealings were legitimate. According to Wesley, it was not unusual for bar owners to borrow money from outside sources because banks often didn't like to do business with them. While Gene and the rest of the children had life insurance on them, it was only for the amount of $6,500, so it seemed unlikely that the murders were financially motivated. Investigators looked into the possibility that Wesley could have made some enemies who murdered his family as revenge, as narcotics trafficking was a very prominent issue within many establishments in Harlem. While Wesley acknowledged that there were a few incidents in which he had to kick drug dealers out of his bars, no criminal charges were ever filed in relation to any of these incidents, and even though a thorough investigation was performed into Wesley's background, no evidence could be found that he was involved in narcotics or any other criminal activity. While many residents of Teaneck did not know Wesley all that well since he was away from home a lot, a number of his friends and associates from Harlem openly expressed their support for him, describing Wesley as an honest, hard-working man who never would have done anything to harm his family. At the funeral for his wife and children, a family friend read a statement on Wesley's behalf that he had written for his deceased family, quote, "I am a better person for having been exposed to you. I gave you shelter, and now I ask each one of you to forgive me for not sheltering you in your greatest hour of need, and to give me the strength to go on without you. Love, Daddy." End quote. Following the crime, Wesley could not bring himself to spend another night at his house in Teaneck, prompting him to sell the place and permanently move into an apartment in Manhattan. He also sold controlling interest of all four of his bars to his brother Arnold and put up a $10,000 reward for information, which led to an arrest for his family's murders. Wesley became very critical of the investigation from the Bergen County authorities, as he believed they were continuing to place too much focus on him, even though he was not considered a suspect. At one point, Wesley wrote a letter to President Gerald Ford and asked him to send in the FBI to investigate the case, but the request was turned down since the FBI did not have jurisdiction on homicides. However, in subsequent years, a New York police detective named James Veedy would publicly present his own theory. Since he believed the Bergen County authorities were not taking his theory seriously, he decided to share it in the newspapers. In the days following the murders, an informant named Tecumseh Robinson had reportedly been seen with between $15,000 to $20,000 in $100 bills, and he eventually told police that he was involved in a conspiracy to rob the Diggs residence. Robinson implicated a man who was currently serving a life sentence in prison for another murder, as well as this man's girlfriend, who had pled guilty to attempted homicide in the same crime before she was released on parole. While Robinson denied taking part in the murders himself, he claimed that the man and woman wanted to rob the Diggs residence because Wesley kept the cash receipts from his bars there. Gene supposedly knew this woman, which is why the perpetrators were let inside the house without any signs of forced entry, and Gene and the children wound up being killed because they were witnesses. One of the suspects owned a blue Plymouth at that time, and a vehicle matching that description was reportedly seen near the Diggs residence on the night of the murders. Robinson did pass a polygraph test when he shared this story, so he was paid by the NYPD for his information and wired with an expensive microphone, but while he was under police surveillance, Robinson went into a Harlem bar and slipped out the side door to escape them. The microphone was later found smashed inside Robinson's car, and police had no luck finding him again. For this reason, the Bergen County Prosecutor's Office did not consider Robinson to be a credible witness and disbelieved his story. Wesley was acquainted with Robinson because he was a patron at one of his bars, but denied knowing the woman Robinson mentioned and did not believe Gene knew her either. He also denied that he ever kept large sums of money inside his house. No evidence was ever found to substantiate Veedy's theory, and the Bergen County authorities completely dismissed it. In June of 1979, Wesley did an interview for the New Jersey newspaper The Record in which he expressed his frustration over the lack of progress with the investigation and the fact that he continued to live under a cloud of suspicion. He stated, quote, "I'm not proud of some of the things I've done, but the only way I felt that I could be of assistance in finding my family's murderer was to tell the police everything. I've never lied, and my story never varied. The fact that they're still looking at me at this late date tells me that they're really not doing anything," end quote. 2 years later, a book about the case was released titled Diggs. It was written by Bob Chase, the reverend who officiated the Diggs family's funeral, and it not only chronicled the murders, but Wesley's personal torment over the case not being solved. Wesley paid his own money to have the book printed and distributed, as it was rejected by numerous publishers because the story, quote-unquote, had no ending. Chase expressed his belief that there was an undercurrent of racism in the original investigation, and that police had the misguided belief that anyone who ran multiple bars in Harlem had to be involved in criminal activity in some way. After his move to Manhattan, Wesley wound up fathering another daughter, but the stress of the situation took a major toll on his health, and he would suffer a series of minor strokes over the years. In October of 1987, he finally succumbed to a fatal heart attack at the age of 52 and was buried alongside his wife and children. In the years following the murders, Teaneck High School established the Audrey Diggs Memorial Award, as Audrey had been a very skilled athlete who played a variety of sports there, so this award was presented annually to a senior female athlete. In 1991, a local resident from Teaneck decided to contact Unsolved Mysteries to see if they would feature the case, but the show would respond with a letter in which they stated this was not possible because the local authorities would not cooperate with them due to the ongoing investigation. While the Bergen County Prosecutor's Office has periodically reviewed the case, they have not been left with very much evidence to work with, as the murder weapon was never recovered and no outside DNA was found at the scene. Investigators believe the only way this case might receive closure is through a deathbed confession or if someone came forward with information, but after nearly 45 years, the Diggs family murders continue to remain unsolved. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. Even though this crime was a pretty big deal in New Jersey and New York at the time it took place, it's not that well known today. I'd wager that the majority of you have never heard of it, which is pretty surprising, considering that it involves the murders of a woman and her children. You get the sense that many of the people investigating the case were completely perplexed and just threw their hands up in the air because they had so little to work with. I mean, there was virtually no evidence left behind, and no one else in the neighborhood seemed to see or hear a thing. But when you consider the fact that all of these children were each shot multiple times in the head, execution style, you have to think there was something really personal about this crime. You might recall that I covered a similar case on this podcast last month, when I released an episode about the Mills family murders, which also involved a family being shot execution style inside their home. But at least in that case, there were a number of plausible theories to work with, but nothing about the murders of the Diggs family makes any sense at all. Here we have a surviving father, Wesley, who was absent when his wife and children were massacred, and considering that he was often away from home, and his alibi involved spending the night with his mistress, you can see why people might be suspicious of him. But as hard as they tried, investigators just could not uncover any tangible evidence to prove that Wesley was involved or had more knowledge about what happened than he was letting on. Yes, it does seem plausible that this crime could have been a revenge killing, which was orchestrated by someone whom Wesley had made enemies with, yet that angle has also led nowhere. Even if Wesley owed people money, or angered some drug dealers by kicking them out of one of his bars, would this really have prompted someone to go to the extreme length of murdering a woman and four children to get back at him? Well, there's one alternate theory I haven't addressed yet, but I should first discuss a movie which recently came out that was based on this story. The film in question is titled American Whisper, and to be quite frank, it's one of the more unusual true crime flicks I've ever seen. While putting together this episode, I discovered that the movie had just been released on Amazon Prime a few months ago, so I decided to give it a viewing. It's a low-budget independent production, and the story is definitely based on the Diggs family murders, as it involves an African-American bar owner who returns home to discover that his wife and children have been shot to death, and he is accused of being involved in their deaths. The character names have all been changed, as the man representing Wesley Diggs is known as Josiah Whisper, hence the film's title, and even though the story is fictionalized, it does contain a lot of actual details from the real-life case. In fact, in some of the press material, the filmmakers mentioned that the plot was based on, quote-unquote, withheld police reports issued at the time of the murders. However, American Whisper makes some dramatic choices which are odd, to say the least. For some reason, the story is set in 2016 instead of 1975, and it's done in the style of a found footage film, meaning that it's shot from the point of view of a handheld camera being carried by a videographer who is following the lead character around. But the thing which took me by complete surprise was the twist ending, so I guess I should issue a spoiler alert if there's anyone out there planning to watch this movie someday. Well, the big reveal is that the crime was a murder-suicide from Josiah Whisper's wife, as she became so frustrated over her husband never being home and conducting extramarital affairs that she finally snapped and shot her children before turning the gun on herself. And it turns out the reason that the murder weapon is not found at the house is because the wife's sister arrived there before anyone else, so she decided to take the gun and get rid of it in order to protect her sibling's reputation, which is why everyone assumes the family was shot by an outside intruder. Well, I have to admit that I initially had a major WTF reaction to that ending, because if you're going to do a fictionalized movie based on a real-life crime, it seems pretty disrespectful to imply that one of the victims was a monster who murdered her own children. From everything I read about Jean Diggs, nobody had a bad thing to say about her, so why tarnish her memory like that? But to my surprise, I soon discovered that the scenario actually had some basis in reality. During the early stages of the investigation, the murder-suicide theory was dismissed, but years later, a Teaneck police detective named Fred Green started working the case, and after looking at the evidence, he came to a different conclusion. By Wesley's own admission, Jean was depressed in the months leading up to her death, not only because he was away from home a lot, but because she lost her own father to diabetes. In fact, a week before the murders, Jean apparently told a friend, quote, "My family would be better off in God's hands." A search of Jean and Audrey's diaries would reveal that they had a bit of a hostile relationship, and since Wesley considered Audrey to be his favorite child, a hint of jealousy could apparently be found in Jean's writing. Lieutenant Green's theory is that Jean and Audrey got into a heated confrontation, which led to Jean shooting her daughter several times. Jean then responded by fatally shooting her other children before she went downstairs to the basement rec room and turned the gun on herself. Now, on the surface, that doesn't sound like it makes much sense, as Jean was shot in both the chest and her forehead, and no gun was found at the scene. However, Green's explanation for this is that Jean shot herself in the forehead, but did not actually succeed at ending her life. At some point before the police arrived, an unknown third party entered the house and discovered what Jean had done, and after noticing that she was technically still alive downstairs, this person decided to finish the job by shooting her a second time in the chest before they got rid of the murder weapon. In his official report, Green stated, quote, "We can show she was alive when she was shot the second time. My recommendation is that we no longer consider this 5 homicides, but that it was actually 4 homicides, an attempted suicide, and another homicide," end quote. So what evidence does Green have to support this theory? Well, I mentioned earlier that Jean kept a .22 caliber pistol inside the kitchen for her own protection, but it was never found. There was gunpowder surrounding Jean's head wound, but not her chest wound, which seemed to indicate that that particular shot came from a distance. Significant traces of gunpowder were found on Jean's pants, which could have been caused if she fired a gun into her forehead from a downward angle. A pillow happened to be missing from Audrey's bed, and an empty pillowcase was found nearby. A white substance, believed to be part of a pillow, could be found near Jean's chest wound, but not her head wound, and the same white substance was also found scattered in line with the trajectory of shots fired into the various walls of the rooms where the victims were killed. Green's theory was that when this unknown third party entered the house and fired a second shot into Jean's chest, they used a missing pillow to muffle the sound of the gunshot, which would explain why this white substance was found near that particular wound. To cover up Jean's complicity, this person also wanted to give off the false impression that a mad gunman entered the house and murdered the entire family, which is why they fired some additional bullets into the walls of the rooms where the shootings took place. Once again, they used a pillow to muffle the sound of these shots, which is why traces of this white substance could be found in the walls. It's also worth noting that when Wesley tried to call for help after discovering Audrey's body, he claimed that the phone was dead. I've been unable to confirm if the house's phone lines had been cut, but if they were, it's possible this was staged to give off the false impression of the crime being a home invasion. During an interview, Green said he believed he knew the identity of this person who fired the second shot into Jean, but he declined to name them, though he did confirm that he did not think it was Wesley. For his part, Wesley was pretty dismissive of the theory and expressed his skepticism that Jean was responsible for what happened. Now, this is a subject in which I have to tread lightly, because I do not want to paint a woman who may be a completely innocent victim as someone who would murder their own children. But I have to admit that the theory was more intriguing than I expected, and I do find it interesting that Jean's own .22-caliber weapon could not be accounted for. If the whole thing escalated after a fight with Audrey, this might explain why she was shot 5 times more than any of the other victims, and why the circumstances of Jean's death were a bit different than her children's. There's also the fact that 3 of the shell casings found at the scene came from an entirely different .22, which would seem to suggest that 2 perpetrators were involved, but perhaps this unknown third party had their own .22 and used it to fire some additional shots in order to make it look like the crime was committed by outsiders. But the big obstacle I can't overcome is the idea that someone would enter that home, discover that 4 children had been murdered, and their first instinct would be to shoot Jean again and dispose of the murder weapon, thereby potentially allowing themselves to be charged with obstruction of justice or even murder. Who would have the motive to do something like that? Theoretically, Wesley could have done it, since his wife's decision to orchestrate a murder-suicide over his failures as a husband and father would reflect badly on him. It could also account for why Wesley gave off the impression that he knew more about the crime than he was letting on, even if he wasn't directly involved. In fact, the first time Wesley was interrogated by the police, one of the detectives apparently pushed forward the idea that he came home to discover his wife had murdered her children and killed her out of revenge, though this was likely said strictly for intimidation reasons, since the initial investigation ruled out murder-suicide. But it sounds like Lieutenant Green was convinced that Wesley was 100% innocent. I mentioned earlier that in An American Whisper, the fictional wife character has a sister who decided to get rid of the gun and cover up the crime on her behalf, but I don't know if Jean had anyone in her actual personal life who would have been willing to do something like that for her. It would have been interesting to hear Green's theory about whom he personally believed this unknown third party was, but without knowing that information, it's hard to determine if this story has any real legs or if he was completely out to lunch. One of the oddest details of this crime is that Audrey's body was found on the bed inside the bedroom of her brother, Wesley Jr., while Wesley Jr. himself was found inside his brother Roger's room on top of Roger's bed alongside him. So the implication would seem to be that Audrey was shot in Wesley Jr.'s room, possibly while he was there, and the shooter then took Wesley Jr. to Roger's room in order to shoot both brothers. At some point, the killer also went up into the attic to murder Allison in her bed, and the evidence suggests that she was told to turn on her side before she was shot in the back of the head. So could things have escalated so badly that Jean shot Audrey and then decided to kill the rest of her children in response? Well, if that is what happened, it would explain why investigators have had no luck solving this case these past 45 years, as it's really hard to make a murder-suicide ruling if no gun is found at the scene. But we also have to explore alternate theories. On the surface, the crime really does seem to fit the profile of a professional hit. If the killer was an outside intruder, many people believe it would have been someone known to the family, as they seem to know the layout of the house, and Jean may have even let them inside voluntarily. Of course, if Wesley was the killer, it would explain an awful lot, but the approximate time of death was determined to be between 11 p.m. and 2 a.m., and it sounds like Wesley has a pretty solid alibi during that time period, as a number of witnesses placed him at one of his bars in Harlem before he spent the night with his mistress, though admittedly, when you have to admit that you're cheating on your wife in order to corroborate your alibi, that doesn't look very flattering. I guess the alternate explanation is that Wesley could have hired someone to visit his home and murder his family while he was spending the night in New York City. Wesley was in heavy debt and borrowing a lot of money in order to maintain all the bars he owned, though it's not like he was in dire financial straits, and as far as I can tell, he was still paying back his weekly installments. The only life insurance payout Wesley would have received from his family's deaths was in the amount of $6,500, which hardly seems worth it. But if he considered his wife and children to be a financial burden and wanted to leave a suburban family life behind and start over by moving to the big city, that could have given him incentive to do this. However, the investigation never uncovered any financial irregularities to suggest that Wesley paid anyone to kill his family, and he did a lot to keep the case in the spotlight. Remember, he actually sent in a request for the FBI to take over the case, which seems like a brazen thing to do if he was complicit. He also published and released a book about the murders, which he financed with his own money. I know that some of the investigators complained that Wesley used the book to make law enforcement look bad and portray himself as a saint, which may be true, but unfortunately, the book is long out of print, so I was unable to read it and judge for myself. But considering that he went on to suffer numerous health problems and wound up dying of a heart attack only 12 years later, it really does seem apparent that whatever his flaws may have been as a human being, the loss of his family did take an enormous toll on Wesley. Now, Wesley always maintained that he never withheld any information from the police, and that if he made any enemies that would have had a motive to murder his wife and children, he had no idea who they were. Well, the investigation never turned up any evidence that Wesley was involved in criminal activity, and I do think there's some truth to the allegations that the police had a hard time getting past their racial prejudice and wrapping their heads around the idea that an African-American who operated four bars in Harlem could have achieved all of that without breaking the law. I mean, at one point, a Teaneck police detective actually pretended to be a mob affiliate and went undercover into the world of Harlem drug traffickers, but he came up with nothing which could have shed any light on what happened to the Diggs family. However, during this time period, a surprising number of shootings occurred which had a connection to Wesley's bars. In fact, on December the 5th, 1975, the same night his family was murdered, Wesley had an incident at his bar, Diggs's Den, where he asked an 18-year-old patron named Daryl Sculliark to leave because he was playing shuffleboard without purchasing any drinks. Sculliark left without causing any trouble, but several hours later, he would be shot to death while attending a Smokey Robinson concert at the Apollo Theater. Well, Sculliark's death was determined to have no connection to the Diggs murders, and it was just a coincidence that the crime happened to take place around the exact same time. 5 days later, on December the 10th, 38-year-old Stanley Morgan, another Harlem bar owner who was acquainted with Wesley, was killed inside his own establishment, the Shalimar Lounge, located less than a mile from Diggs's Den. A pair of unidentified black men walked into the bar and fired 6 shots into Morgan from a pair of .22-caliber weapons before leaving. I don't believe this murder was ever solved, but Morgan was a major heroin trafficker in Harlem, and there were apparently rumors that one of Wesley's relatives worked as a drug dealer for him. The .22 shell casings from the Morgan murder were compared with the shell casings from the Diggs residence, and they did not match, and authorities became satisfied that the two crimes were not connected. Following the death of his family, Wesley sold full control of his bars to his 43-year-old brother, Arnold Diggs, and believe it or not, Arnold would soon find himself involved in his own shooting. On February the 24th, 1976, Arnold was working inside one of the bars, the Yardbird Bar and Grill, when an unidentified gunman decided to start firing shots at a patron who was standing outside, wounding him in the cheek. One of the bullets wound up passing through the bar's front window and grazed Arnold in the cheek. Both Arnold and the patron survived the attack, but I don't believe they caught the gunman or determined his motive. Once again, investigators determined that this incident likely had no connection to the Diggs murders, but here's an interesting side story involving Arnold. While the funeral for Jean and the children was being prepared, Arnold inexplicably decided to disappear for 2 days, which caused some major friction between him and Wesley, which never really boiled over. According to Wesley, Arnold told him that he just needed to get away for a while, but he never did reveal where exactly he went. Regardless, Arnold was questioned and passed a polygraph, and he was never considered a suspect. All this additional drama with Arnold probably has nothing to do with the crime, but it's crazy to think that in this 1 2-month period surrounding the murders, there were 3 additional shootings which had a tangible connection to Wesley's bars. The only scenario which has come up where specific criminals have been looked at as promising suspects is in the theory presented by James Veedy, the New York detective who believed that the Diggs family were murdered during a robbery attempt. This information came from an informant, Tecumseh Robinson, who implicated a convicted murderer and his girlfriend, and claimed this was an attempt to steal the cash receipts from Wesley's bars. Now, Wesley maintained that he never kept money stashed at his house, though it is interesting to note that before he discovered his family's bodies, he had picked up the cash receipts from all of his bars and was carrying around $1,000 on him when he arrived home. So if this was his ordinary routine, you could see how people might be under the impression that he had a large amount of cash at his residence. And the presence of shell casings from 2 different 22 caliber weapons at the residence does give off the impression that multiple perpetrators were involved. But the big problem with the theory is that it's based entirely on the word of Tecumseh Robinson, who does not seem like the most reliable source, especially when you consider that he decided to take the police's money and run off while he was under their surveillance. I could not find any other information about Robinson online, other than an old legal appeal which was filed on his behalf after he was arrested on a gun possession charge in 1962, so I'm not sure if the police ever found him after he slipped away. But the fact that Robinson implicated a guy who was already serving a life sentence for another murder is awfully convenient. Overall, I just cannot see robbery being the primary motive for this crime, mainly because there was no sign of any ransacking in the house. If Wesley is telling the truth, and there was no money to be found, you'd think that whoever was responsible would have at least torn the place apart while looking for it. But as you might recall, one police officer described the residence as the cleanest crime scene he'd ever seen, so you get the impression that someone entered the house with the sole intention of killing the family and left immediately after they were done. Once again, the entire crime has a personal vibe to it. Now, during the early stages of the investigation, Wesley himself pushed forward a theory in interviews about a boyfriend of Audrey's possibly being involved, as Jean apparently did not like this boyfriend and told him to stop coming by the house. There's no other information available out there about this boyfriend, so it's possible police already looked into this angle and ruled it out, but if Audrey was always the intended target, it would provide a potential explanation for why she was shot more times than anyone else. I just can't overlook the oddity of Audrey being found on the bed which belonged to her brother, Wesley Jr. If an intruder entered the residence and went after Audrey, it's possible she ran into Wesley Jr.'s room to escape, where she wound up being shot, and since Wesley Jr. was a witness to the crime, he was taken into Roger's room to be killed, and the intruder decided to wipe out the entire family. The fact that Jean's personal .22 caliber gun was missing has been used as evidence to support the murder-suicide theory, but it's also possible she grabbed it in an attempt to defend her children from someone else. She may have fired off a few unsuccessful shots that only hit the wall, which might account for the 3 shell casings found at the scene that didn't match the others, or the perpetrator might have overpowered her and grabbed the gun, and took it with them when they left the scene. But it's really hard to get a grasp on who would have had a motive to do this. If you're looking for a wildcard theory, perhaps these murders were a hate crime and the Diggs family were targeted simply because of the race. I always say that when you come across a crime in which African-American victims were senselessly murdered, and there doesn't seem to be any discernible motive, you can never discount the possibility of racism, because for some people, racism is all the motive they need. Even though Teaneck was known for being a racially equanimous community during the 1970s, there still could have been some residents who had a major problem with an African-American family living in their neighborhood and decided to kill them for it. It may have been someone who did not even know the family personally, and if Wesley just happened to be sleeping over on that particular night, he would have been killed too. Yes, this is all just pure speculation, and there's no real evidence to support this hate crime scenario, but since none of the other theories make any sense, it would not surprise me if this happened. I don't know, I just think this case is a head-scratcher. I really do not want to subscribe to the murder-suicide theory, because Jane sounded like a legitimately good person, and I wouldn't want to sully your memory if there's no truth to this theory at all. Yet at the same time, it would account for a lot of the oddities in this case, and if the crime was committed by someone inside the house, that would certainly explain the almost complete lack of evidence pointing to outside intruders. However, the idea of an unknown third party firing a second bullet into Jean and staging the crime scene to make it look like someone else did it does sound pretty far-fetched. If that is what happened, then I guess the only way this case could conceivably be solved is if they ever figure out the identity of this unknown third party, and that person admits to what they did. I will say that if Wesley Diggs was completely 100% innocent in all this, and had no involvement or knowledge about what happened, then I just feel awful for him, because not only did he lose his wife and four children, but he had to live under a constant cloud of suspicions for the rest of his life, and died at a relatively young age, likely due to the stress of this whole ordeal. When Wesley passed away in 1987, and The Record published his obituary, the headline they used was, "Secret Going to the Grave." But weeks later, The Record published an angry letter from Reverend Bob Chase, who took issue with that headline, and insisted that Wesley shared everything he knew and took no secrets to his grave. However, if Wesley did genuinely believe that the crime was a murder-suicide on his wife's part, then that must have been a heavy burden to carry. I've done quite a few episodes on cases where entire families are murdered, and most of the time, I can at least come up with a plausible idea of what happened, but on this one, I'm really not sure. So if you happen to have any information on the unsolved murders of Jean, Audrey, Allison, Wesley Jr., and Roger Diggs, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this past month, we released an episode about the bizarre story of Jody Roberts, who went missing in Washington State in 1985 before she was discovered to be alive and living under a new identity 12 years later after suffering an apparent case of amnesia. So to learn more information, feel free to visit our Patreon page. I'd also like to give a shout out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Valens999, Simon M, Alicia C, Inez H, Keel B, and Sandra G. Thank you all so much for your support. And before I bring this episode to a close, I'd like to play a promo for another true crime podcast from a fellow Canadian, the Nighttime Podcast.
Canada. The Great White North. A utopia of manners, healthcare, and big-hearted people saying hey. Sadly, that place doesn't exist. I'm Jordan, and on my show Nighttime, I uncover a version of Canada that is far darker than the one used in advertising to sell coffee, beer, and cars. The Canada I discuss on Nighttime is a twisted maze of crime, missing persons cases, unexplained events, and stories that prove Canada is not what they want you to think. If you want to join me, subscribe to the Nighttime Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or anywhere else.
I also just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to McGill Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, or Spotify. Anyway, for many reasons, the world is in a pretty chaotic place right now, so I hope that everyone listening stays safe out there. Like I mentioned in the intro, for the next month, our podcast is exclusively going to be releasing episodes about cold cases in which the victims were persons of color. You may not be familiar with some of these stories, but they deserve to be shared. So have yourselves a great week, and join us next Wednesday for our next episode of The Trail Went Cold.